Welcome to the LCFAOD edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the fatty acid oxidation disorder community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're talking today with Eileen Sullivan Baker, an Ohio attorney whose oldest son, John, 24, has long-chain fatty acid oxidation disorder. Eileen recently spoke at the virtual University of Pittsburgh's INFORM lecture series, sponsored by INFORM, which is the International Network for Fatty Acid Oxidation Research and Management. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Yes, my topic today in my lecture was the burden of the healthcare system and the navigating that in people living with LCFAOD, or long-chain fatty acid oxidation disorders, and how they can help bridge with their care team having this particular disorder. I have a son. My firstborn had a relatively normal pregnancy, but noticed when he would have any kind of illness, he was often hospitalized. And at the time, there was not a newborn screen for the particular disorder that he currently has. When we first discovered that this was a life-threatening illness, it was after an episode of a normal flu virus that at age 2.5, he contracted. We brought him to the hospital and he was coding in the hospital, and there seemed to be some discussion of what he might have. There were guesses on what he might have, but because of his test results, he was in significant rhabdomyolysis, which is a rapid muscle breakdown. He was acutely paralyzed, as they would tell me, and could not move his legs, his arms, was beginning to be able to take shorter breaths. So they put him in ICU and believed initially that he had something called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Through much hospitalization and rehab after that incident, we were unsure and had to discover what was wrong with him. And this is kind of why my topic was the burden of the healthcare system, because at that time we had no diagnosis. We had symptoms. We had to take him to various healthcare providers, including an immunologist, a cardiologist, a pediatric pulmonologist. We also then were referred to a physiatrist who specialized in occupation and physical therapy. We began physical therapy and he was in physical therapy for the next 6 months in order to regain his ability to walk.
And how old was he at this point?
He was 3 at this point. All seemed to be better. He had another growth spurt at about 4.5, caught another virus in the fall, and we were again back in the hospital with what someone determined must have been one of these rare diseases, as the doctors would say, in the intensive care, but they did not know what it was.
Just a question, 20 years ago or 24 years ago, not a lot was known about these fatty acid oxidation disorders at all. Was there any suspicion that he had this?
There was no suspicion that he had a fatty acid oxidation disorder. They believed that possibly, the experts believed that possibly he had some form of muscular dystrophy. They were going down that route, but because this was an acute onset resulting in this sort of decomposition after a virus, they then began to believe maybe it was a problem with his immune system, which is why we went to through the immunology program. They told me not to vaccinate him during this period of time, because again, it was searching for an unknown. They had no idea what was really happening. He then progressed, but whenever he would have a growth spurt, we would notice that he had some weakness. One characteristic that actually he lives with today, he does not have reflexes in his knees or his ankles, which is a telltale sign of someone with this kind of rare disease. It wasn't until he was 14 and attended a trip with his school and had done quite a bit of walking in Washington, D.C., did not have a lot to eat or drink, both conditions that now are known to support metabolic disorders, that you need to make sure you have proper nutrition and hydration. And he ended up having a metabolic crisis. Again, I call it that today, but we did not know what it was then. And we drove to pick him up at the hotel to try to bring him to the hospital. We did bring him back here where the doctors knew him. But again, the burden of the healthcare system to us was that he had a pediatrician at the time. The pediatrician didn't know what was wrong, referred him to specialists We then were seeing a neurologist because he had some weakness. So we had someone doing physical therapy. We had a neurologist. We had an immunologist. We had a pulmonologist, and still searching for answers. We brought him back to hospitalize him after the Washington, D.C. trip. And at that time, he saw a renal specialist. And that doctor determined that, as he called it, something on one of the tests showed that there was a problem with kidney function. And that alerted him to this could possibly be a rare disease. So he said, I think it's genetic. I'm not sure what the genetic makeup is, but I think you need to see a geneticist. Well, in our area, there was no geneticist. So that was almost 10 years ago now. There was a geneticist that came to this area part-time where we live in Ohio, relatively rural area. And we were going to have to travel to Akron. I then decided as a mom, I needed to Google his symptoms and see if there was something out there. And while it's not advisable to do that, that is what I did. I found a specialist that was researching this kind of symptom, this rapid muscle breakdown causing weakness and someone unable to walk after a viral illness. I found a researcher in Cleveland. So I originally went to Cleveland. We had had screening for muscular dystrophy. We had had other screenings for other kind of known illnesses, and none of those showed that this is what John had. What we learned was they initially had been able to screen for some 50 different genes. At the time we went, it had just expanded to 250. They wanted to do a muscle biopsy, not in Cleveland, but at another facility that we went to. And because this was acute, and I have some medical professionals in my background, they said with an acute illness like this, it's not progressive. Doing a muscle biopsy may not show you anything unless he's in the middle of a crisis. I opted not to do the muscle biopsy. We found a specialist in Cleveland who was a pediatric neurologist that specialized in metabolic disorders. And we went to him. He did a skin biopsy. And within a couple of weeks, determined that John was suffering from long-chain fatty acid oxidation disorder, specifically trifunctional protein deficiency.
That brings me to my next question. In your work as a patient advocate, you have testified in Washington, you've spoken before the FDA, etc. But at the time of his diagnosis, I'm guessing that you are not familiar with this disease and you knew nobody else who either had the disease or parents whose children had the disease. Is that right?
That's right. And when you research what this is, now that it's been labeled, the mortality rate and any research on this was pretty dark and devastating. And I was looking at my son thinking, I understand that's what the prognosis may have been in this literature, but this does not seem to be what we're living. And so I was very motivated to seek out professionals that might be researching this.
Okay. And also at the time, there were no groups or patient advocacy organizations. And as far as I understand, there still isn't an organization such as Multiple Sclerosis Society, Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, Cure Duchenne, groups, of course, that represent patients who number in the thousands. This is also a rare disease, and yet, for some reason, not sure why, there doesn't seem to be any cohesive organization representing such patients. Why do you think that is?
So I think early on, because we didn't have the ability to test for the genetics and we weren't able to identify the genes that may have made up these rare diseases in the metabolic disorder, like long chain fatty acid oxidation, there were more support groups. There was a grief support group that may have given information about these diseases, but there were children who passed away as a result of not being able to get the care because it wasn't known in science. We have recently been able to fall under the umbrella of MitoAction. MitoAction is an organization that serves patients that have mitochondrial disorders. The long chain fatty acid oxidation disorders do fall under this, although they have a metabolic component with rhabdomyolysis, which is the rapid muscle breakdown, that is not always known.
Is John currently on Dojolvi?
So some of the patients are taking Dojolvi that can tolerate it, but some patients cannot tolerate it. So it is not a prescription medication that he's on. He takes the supplement, but again, part of this disorder is that there is still a population that believes you can moderate the incidence of this genetic problem with just nutrition. But what we know with regard to the metabolic system in middle school and high school and the hormonal changes that occur throughout your life, there are chemical requirements to support that your body function, essentially. And Dojolvi really helps some patients. It isn't recommended for all patients, but we didn't have anything back in 2018. So very rapidly, we now have an approved drug.
And just if you could describe for us, what is it like in the course of daily life? I'm assuming that as with other patients with this disorder, he's got to eat constantly. He cannot fast. He cannot be without food or water for very long, or he'll have a serious crisis.
So as an infant and as a toddler and probably up till about fifth grade, it was really kind of easy for mom to manage that because you provide all the meals. But for a patient living with that gets older, activities take them away to places. So the constant reminder of, do you have your Gatorade? Do you have your water? Do you have your snacks? It can kind of play negatively in a relationship with a mother and a child or a father and a child. But it is that you have to remember. So if we would travel anywhere, snacks, we'd always have to have snacks. We couldn't go more than 2 to 3 hours without having some sort of meal. Funny story, recently we have gallon water jugs that we use. Not that we don't, I mean, we have fine tap water, but John prefers these gallon water jugs, and we couldn't get them from the retailer that we always got them from. And we've been waiting and waiting for them. So we have almost a pallet of these gallon water jugs because he's working here in Ohio this summer for his job. And he probably goes through one of those a day. It is low fat. And so that's required us and our family to make sure we sort of limit some of the things that we can do. And those kinds of treats, he knows based on how he feels whether he can have them. So if we all want to go, for instance, to a restaurant that has more of American cuisine and not a lot of vegetables, he has to moderate and look at what he's eaten over the last 5 or 6 days to be able to say, yes, I can enjoy these French fries or this piece of pizza because of what I've done in the past.
Real quickly, you mentioned several times about going to Washington. What's the nature of your testimony before the FDA, and what kind of patient advocacy work are you able to perform as a representative of this Rare Disease Advisory Council of Ohio?
So the Rare Disease Advisory Council has just begun. It's a 2-year appointment. And with regard to that, we are setting out some goals. Our mission is to make sure that we are able to put forth to the legislatures clearly what might be needed for the rare disease patient population in the state of Ohio. So we've just begun that. We've only had one meeting, and I'm going to co-chair a committee with another member in the education and research of rare disease, because I found that in Ohio, it may not have been as well known as it might have been a little east. And that was confirmed by some of the physicians, that where you live in the United States may somehow dictate what's being researched. So I serve on that committee. It's a public committee. We have quarterly meetings, and the next one coming up in August. As to Washington, D.C., we had a group, myself, two other patients, wrote a letter to the FDA urging them to approve a study drug. We participate in studies whenever we can. I get John involved, have been getting John involved when he was a minor, and now as an adult, if there are a study out there, he will sign up for it. And C7, which is now Dojolvi, was being studied. And we wrote a letter urging the FDA to approve this. As a result of this, we were able to go and appear before the FDA and really explain what the experience was of the patient and the burden on the caregiver without some clear medication for these disorders. So we appeared before a panel. And with all of the research, primary research being Dr. Vockley, at the University of Pittsburgh. He attended that. Patients were given a chance to, I think we have five patients there that were given a chance to tell the FDA what life is like living with a rare disease without having the supportive C7, which now has been an approved drug called Dojolvi.
And this is the first time the FDA has ever approved a drug for long-chain fatty acid oxidation disorder, right?
It is. Ultragenyx has been a huge researcher in these kinds of rare diseases, and we were very grateful that they supported this patient population with regard to the research and the production of this, along with Dr. Vockley.
Eileen, thank you very much for talking with us. This has been very useful, and I'm sure our listeners have learned quite a bit listening to this presentation today. This is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. Thank you.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.